Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for being with us. There's been a lot of attention this week on Russia's influence in American politics, and a lot of people were glued to their TVs or devices following former FBI Director James Comey's testimony before a Senate hearing yesterday. And a leaked NSA report raised new questions about Russian efforts to undermine the 2016 election. This week, researchers with the University of Michigan said there's no evidence hacking affected the outcome of Wisconsin's presidential vote count. Here's one of the researchers, graduate student Matt Bernhard.
I do think there were, cyber operations on behalf of the Russian government and perhaps other actors as well, I don't know, that were intent on interfering with the election results and affecting the outcome of the election. But what I mean when I say the election wasn't hacked is I mean that nobody put malware on voting machines that flipped votes or changed votes to the extent that it changed the outcome of the election. And that's like a really like nuanced thing. So basically what I'm saying is that there might have been foul play that happened, but whoever was doing it wasn't competent enough to actually change the outcome.
The issue of Russian involvement in the elections is something that raised questions even in northern Wisconsin, when IT workers in Ashland and Bayfield County saw a small increase in Russian traffic on their websites last year. But Bayfield County Clerk Scott Feibert says there's no evidence to suggest any impact on elections.
Nothing of my elections would have been interfered with by anything through the internet, that any traffic that came to Bayfield County.
But Bernhard says their research shows elections are incredibly vulnerable. He and fellow researchers recommend that elections officials conduct what's called risk-limiting audits, where a small sample of paper ballots are counted to verify the outcome. Long-term, the researcher says all voting machines should be replaced with those that are more resilient to cyber attacks. Feibert says the county is beginning to plan for replacement of voting machines within the next 3 to 5 years, but he says researchers' findings that tampering didn't change the outcome of the election should give voters confidence.
It was a non-event in Bayfield County, and we want to make sure people have that feeling of comfort that the systems work instead of the other way around, especially when we went through all this trouble to prove it.
In other news for Bayfield County, it will argue its case against the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources in court next month. The two are at odds over a county ordinance that would place more restrictions on large-scale farms to protect water quality there. Bayfield County's ordinance goes beyond state standards for regulating concentrated animal feeding operations. It would affect large farms that locate near a watershed that runs into Lake Superior. Iowa-based Reichsview Farms plans to build a farm upstream for about 26,000 hogs. The Wisconsin DNR rejected the county's ordinance. The two parties have been trying to reach common ground, but county attorney Linda Coleman says negotiations broke down.
The DNR filed a response through their attorneys, and we have filed our reply brief. So all briefs are in, and the next step is oral arguments in front of the Bayfield County Court.
The DNR declined to comment, but its attorneys say the ordinance won't clean up the watershed because it does nothing to address phosphorus runoff from existing farms. Oral arguments in the case have been scheduled for July 10th at 3 p.m. at the Bayfield County Courthouse in Washburn. The city of Superior announced big news this week with plans to build a $700 million natural gas facility there. Minnesota Power and Dairyland Power Cooperative are teaming up to build the power plant along the Nemadji River in Superior. It's expected to produce up to 550 megawatts of power. Superior Mayor Jim Payne spoke with me by phone on Wednesday about the project. He says the city and county have been working behind the scenes on it for the last year.
The city and the county were involved, and so I had a relatively minimal role. I was aware of it at the county side, and then was brought in, of course, after the election on this project. But they've been moving towards this announcement for about a year. They've been acquiring the property for several years now, but they really felt this was the right time to move on a state-of-the-art facility. So it's been working behind the scenes for quite a while.
So how does it feel then that they're finally announcing that they're moving forward with it?
Well, it's very exciting. It's a really fun day to have to finally have it out in public because I've been excited about this for some time. We have years to go before this is up and running. We need to remember that too, that this is not, you know, happening tomorrow, but it's nice to finally have this out in public. Superior has been selected for the site and we can finally talk publicly about how exciting it is.
Well, what does this mean for the city of Superior and Douglas County then?
This is going to be one of the biggest projects we've ever seen. And so it's definitely exciting for our economy in terms of not just that we're maintaining and growing the industry that we have, but we're adding a new major energy project right here in our community. But I'm also very pleased with what this says about renewable energy and the future of the way we get energy in Wisconsin and Minnesota. This is represents an actual reduction in carbon emissions. Natural gas is cleaner than coal. And it's also part of Minnesota Power and Dairyland Cooperative's efforts to invest more in renewable energy. So this is a backup to their growing investments in perfectly clean energy that allows green energy infrastructure throughout these two states.
And this is also going to add to the city's tax base or the revenues that they draw in?
So yes, this does come with $1.2 million in direct aid from the state of Wisconsin for siting this facility. But the city's end of that will be about $800,000 a year. So that is actual direct revenue that we get in the city of Superior. It is again, one of the largest increases in direct revenue that we've seen in a very long time.
So what does that mean to have like $800,000 a year more coming into the city, given what, you know, we've seen with budgets?
Yeah, I mean, it's just in the nick of time. We have a lot of challenges that we're staring at with our budgets. There are, you know, we receive money from a number of different sources, most of which are declining or aren't increasing along with the cost of city services. So we were looking at deficits nearly every year into the future. So a massive influx of new revenue is very timely, and it's exactly what we need to maintain high-quality services in the city of Superior, but also to actually, for the first time in years, consider new investments. Now, again, this is several years out, you know, so we don't want to get too excited yet, but it's the kind of thing we can look at actual real growth and new investment in this city.
So what needs to be done just, you know, as far as hammering out the details at the city level then to move this project forward?
What is starting right now is the permitting and the regulatory process in both Minnesota and Wisconsin. So Minnesota Power and Dairyland Cooperative, the partnership, has to clear those hurdles first. You know, they siting a natural gas energy facility is a large deal, you know, for the DNR and the Public Service Commission. And so they'll have to clear that in both states. At that point, we may have to look at some infrastructure improvements, but again, that's pretty small potatoes compared to the size of the project. But for the most part, it's shovel ready. It's ready to go.
Well, is there anything I'm missing about this project that you want people to know or that you want to add?
Oh, there's probably plenty that we're missing. This is it's important to note that this is going to be a long process before construction and operation. Several years. I think we're looking at construction around 2020 and operation as late as 2024 or 2025. So in that time, there will still be a number of questions that we need to answer. The public needs to be educated and informed about what this is, what it does, what impacts it has. So we are going to have those conversations over the next couple of years. So we do invite people to ask questions and to come out and talk about it. I hope that the public is as excited about this as I am, but we do have a lot of time to talk about this, and we're going to iron out every wrinkle in this process over the next couple of years.
The project will create around 260 construction jobs and about 25 full-time positions. The plant is expected to be in service by 2024. Minnesota Power and Dairyland Power say the facility is part of their plans to expand use of renewable energy. And speaking of renewable energy, the city of Ashland recently received a state grant to help move the city toward energy independence. As Felicity Bosk reports, the money will be used to realize energy savings in city operations.
Ashland has been awarded about $35,000 from the Wisconsin State Energy Office. The money will be used to update the city's comprehensive energy plan and upgrade equipment at its wastewater treatment facility. Ashland Parks and Rec Director Sarah Hudson says the upgrades translate to cost savings for the city.
The pumps that we currently have run 100% 24 hours a day, so there's only one speed to them. Where these variable control motors that we are going to purchase, they can run at varying speeds depending on the amount of effluent that we have to pump through. So by being able to reduce them or increase them, we're going to be able to save energy.
Hudson says installing energy-efficient equipment at the wastewater treatment facility will save the city around $5,700 a year. She says the city will also use the grant to identify 25 ways Ashland can become more energy efficient.
Streetlights are one of them, with LED lights. Another one was replacing lighting in the Reading Community Center, and we did put in efficient light within our gym. One was at the Public Works Department, and another was with the library. And I think the library was a new boiler system, which we replaced last year. And then the Public Works Department, I believe, was energy efficient lighting also.
Hudson says they plan to examine whether Ashland can install solar panels or wind turbines to reduce energy costs for the city. She says the city will begin making upgrades to its wastewater treatment facility this fall. Felicity Bosk, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Ashland is also getting closer to reclaiming a part of the city's waterfront. Cleanup of the Ashland Northern States Power Lakefront Superfund site has been ongoing for decades. Ashland Mayor Deb Lewis says workers hired by NSP and XL Energy have started dredging up the last of contaminated wood waste and sediments from the city's lakefront.
As you recall, there was a dispute by NSP over the process to be used in the dredging, whether it would be a wet dredge or a dry dredge. The original order by the EPA required a dry dredge technique, which basically would have involved partitioning off little parcels in the bay. It's about a 13-acre area that would have to have then been drained and then dredged. But the EPA left open the opportunity for XL or NSP to do a pilot study to try to prove that the wet dredge technique could be successful. That was completed last summer, and we are told that went well, and as a result of that pilot study, the company was able to get the EPA and the DNR to revise the record of decision, which was the order requiring the method of cleanup. So they've got everything geared up fully, and now we're at a point where the dredging is going to be going on continually all summer this year. And if all goes well, this should be the last year of the actual cleanup part of this remediation project.
Which I know you're looking forward to.
Yes, we're very excited about that. It's been, as you know, about a 25-year process. And there was a lot of uncertainty first about who was going to be doing the cleanup and how it was going to be done. And now we're at the point of actually getting it done. And hopefully it will be done right. We still have our DNR site manager, Jamie Dunn, who I believe has spent his entire career on this project. And this is his baby, and he feels very engaged and invested in making sure this is done right. So, you know, we've made some plans for what happens next. We understand that this year will be tough. It's going to be a lot of truck traffic through the city. It's going to be a lot of occasional smells, just a lot of activity down there. But we're willing to suck it up for one more year, knowing that, you know, the end is near.
Yeah, well, so, and I remember Jamie was telling me, too, that he wasn't going to retire until this project was
done.
That
is correct, yep. So we're getting closer for him.
Yeah.
But next year there will be essentially landscaping on land, and there will be a cap placed and just some final touches to complete the project. So that should not be as disruptive. We're hopeful that we'll get our bike paths back through the area. We have been without that. We've had kind of a interruption in our bike trail along the waterfront for a number of years, And we're looking forward to that, reclaiming that whole lakefront.
And then I know, too, you've got plans for the waterfront and developing it and this vision for it. So what's going on behind the scenes related to that?
Well, last year we were asked to have a concept plan approved, which we did. As you can imagine, when there's a number of competing recreational interests, I call them, different uses for the lake. We have our boating people on the one hand, and we have our green space people on the other. So the final plan is kind of a compromise to allow, you know, all people to have sort of a space for themselves. You know, we have quite a bit of lakefront, so there's a lot of room. Essentially, the plan calls for the western half of the site, the area closest to the current marina, to be marina expansion area. We plan to move our boat launching area to the west side of the site, more closer to the marina. And we're in the process of looking at some grants through the DNR. We're told there is some money still for this to construct four new boat launches on that western side, along with some boat parking areas, potentially some room on land towards the back of the site for an indoor boat storage area for the marina. And then on the eastern side, that will be largely the part towards the current Crare Park and where the current boat launch is. That will be that boat launch site that we're the only boat launch site we have now will be a soft boat landing for quiet boats like kayaks and canoes. And green space and plans call for a pavilion similar to the one in Bayfield on their waterfront. So just hopefully we can have a space where we can have some events down there. We are going to be limited by some of the residual infrastructure that will be left as a result of the remediation. There's some monitoring wells that are there. So, we can't do everything we want to do. You know, it's still going to be public access that we haven't had for a long, long, many years.
Yeah. Well, and I was just thinking, too, because I know that those no swimming signs have been up forever.
Mm-hmm.
People will be able to swim down there again?
Yes, it should be safe. That's what I understand. Safe for swimming, safe for fishing.
Is there anything else that I'm missing then about the next steps in the project and finishing up the cleanup?
You know, I think in general the city has been sort of handicapped by having this tied up for so long. It's been a long time, and we're certainly ready to get past it and reclaim that area.
Northern States Power will still be doing some work next year to help set the stage for the lake ecosystem to recover in that portion of the waterfront. The cleanup is expected to cost up to $97 million. NSP is proposing a 10.1% rate increase to its natural gas customers, a majority of that. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. U.S. and Canadian government, industry, academic, and non-governmental stakeholders have been taking part in what's being dubbed a first-of-its-kind crude oil movement meeting for the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence River Basin. The symposium began yesterday and runs through today in Cleveland, Ohio. The meeting is hosted by the Sea Grant Network, Great Lakes Commission, and International Joint Commission. Dale Bergeron with Minnesota Sea Grant is at the symposium, and he spoke with me about discussions planned to address the hazards and complexity of moving crude in the region.
Well, first of all, we're living in an environment where the Bakken oil fields in North Dakota have been developed, representing about 1 million barrels of oil a day, 2 million coming from the oil sands in Alberta, and there's a pressure to move them to refineries in and around the Great Lakes and through and around the Great Lakes and Great Lakes Basin. And anything that happens in terms of impact in transportation within a basin happens to the water body. everything moves into the water through the air, across the land, or directly into the water. And so for Sea Grant, it's a very important issue. Well, that's an environmental awareness, but there are also social and economic considerations as well. And so we live in a highly mechanized, industrial, modern world, and with great interdependencies. And when you pull one thread, you might unravel all sorts of issues. And that's exactly what happens with crude oil movement. And so we're more focused on the transportation issues than the use of oil itself. That is a given. We're currently using tremendous amounts of oil for a variety of different uses, and everything from plastics to chemical feedstocks, which means the foundation chemicals for fertilizers and a variety of other commercial manufacturing processes, but also for our mobility and our freedom. The fact that you can jump on a plane and fly anywhere in the world or drive your car in any direction you want has to do with the mobility provided by the use of oil. And we're going to turn the corner. We're going to probably continue to explore new energy sources and new strategies. But the trajectory that we're on right now with oil demands a better understanding of how we're moving it and what the triple bottom line is. What are the social, what are the economic, and what are the environmental costs, and how are they balanced? How do we understand them? How do we understand who is accepting what kind of risk? And do we really understand our benefits? So it's a very, very complex system.
Well, and we've seen a lot of changes in recent years. I mean, as there has been more oil production in the Bakken, we saw more oil getting put onto rail, which concerned a lot of communities about whether or not they would be prepared for any emergency if there was a spill. And also we've seen, you know, expansion of pipeline projects, whether it's Enbridge or Keystone or TransCanada. You know, there's all these different things happening. And so what does the transportation picture for crude oil look like right now?
Well, basically, you have to back up to the very beginning of your transportation options. And so you can use truck, you can use trains, you can use ships, and you can use pipelines. And we know that the least environmental impact on the atmosphere, of course, because there's very little fuel used, would be, for example, pipelines. In terms of volume moved, it's pipelines. But in terms of, for example, dramatic events in recent history, pipelines have been in the news. And so depending on how you look at it, it could be a massive spill. If it's in your backyard, it's a massive spill. If you look at it in terms of the millions of barrels used a day and moved across the country, it may be relatively small, in fact, minuscule. And so you have to look at these things and understand what they mean and how they fit into a larger system. And if I use the wrong strategy, we all remember the tragic train accident in Lake Megantic in Canada, where 46 or 47 people were burned to death, and the entire town was burned to the ground because a tanker train derailed and burst into flames. On the one hand, it's a horrific thing, and yet it's a very small point of activity. And so trying to understand what is the relative risk to human beings, human health, environmental integrity, and economic stability, it's very, very complicated. What we're dealing with here is a wicked problem. And that's a very interesting thing. A wicked problem, if you could imagine trying to shoot at a target, it's changing shape and size and distance from you simultaneously with the thing you're trying to shoot changing into a crossbow and a rifle and a tomahawk. And, you know, the idea that everything is changing in every direction on multiple scales, that's modern life. And so we can't use reductionist strategies to either evaluate or review what we're looking at. We have to use a systems approach, and we have to understand integrated relationships. They become even more important than the specifics, the individual events or the individual activities. And so that's what this whole thing is about that we're trying to put together here in the Great Lakes region, is bring together academics, industry, government agencies, NGOs, and interested parties to try to get beyond the place we are today and our defensive postures and our traditional stance of sort of saying, let's have a debate, and integrate and try to have actual discussions and say, how did we get here? How could we optimize the goods and minimize the bads and make the wisest choice possible? If this is going to happen, if we're going to move crude oil, if there's a pressure to move crude oil and our economy is dependent and our social systems are dependent and even our health and environmental well-being is dependent on how we do these things, we need to sit down and talk. So that's how this happened, and it's the direction we're trying to go.
Well, Dale, you talked about how things are changing so much right now. And one of the things that we've seen in the last week is President Trump pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord, which I would imagine is a signal to businesses that you know, if they want to continue using fossil fuels, they can do so and expand on that. But I know that a lot of companies have tried to shift gears, including Enbridge, by trying to build up renewable energy. So how does this change the way we're dealing with crude oil when there's policy involved and that's always shifting?
Exactly. And again, so you have to look at a systems-wide strategy. And so when you're talking about pipelines, for example, Enbridge, like any other, like a trucking company, you know, they just move things. They actually don't even own the oil. But they don't only move oil. They move gasoline and diesel fuel, but they can also move other kinds of gas. And for example, you asked me about pulling out of the climate accord. I don't speak at that level. I'll make that clear. But what I can tell you is that industry is always looking for the least liability and the least cost while maintaining social acceptance, social license to operate. And so, for example, all of freight transportation is moving as quickly as it can worldwide towards liquid natural gas. Well, that's a 100% decrease in NOx, an 89% decrease in SOx, about a 65% decrease in CO2. So phenomenally more efficient engines. And so I think it's an interesting thing. Policy is generally following what's actually happening. It rarely leads. And so I guess I'm not as concerned as some, because I see really good movement in the industry of greater efficiency, a desire to be a better steward. You know, all these people, and you have to remember that a corporation is made of people, are trying to service their community, which is the state, which is part of a federation, which is trying to serve its states. And so, again, all of us are smarter than any of us, and it's only if we dissect the problem and only look at one piece that we start to lose our way. And so, for example, with transportation, I can tell you that every single mode of transportation has a risk, and that there's no good way necessarily, no ideal way to move anything. There was a Forbes headline in 2016 from a story, and it read, "Pipelines, the worst way to move oil, except for all the rest." So it's this problem of we're having to make complicated choices, and we need to do it collaboratively, and we need to address the triple bottom line. We can't be myopic. We can't look at the status quo. And I think you can be assured that industry is continuously trying to reduce its liability, and they would like to make more money. Well, that's the good news. The federal government is trying to make sure that communities have economic opportunity and environmental integrity. And that's a very good thing. And so when we work together, great things are achieved.
So what are the things that you feel need to be addressed to improve crude oil transportation as it exists right now? And is that going to be discussed at this symposium?
I think it is. I mean, I think what we're going to try to do is we're going to talk about what's the distribution of the movement so people have an awareness. And then what we'd like to do is discuss how to make the review of the subject more transparent. So in the past, for example, somebody shipping oil would ask, how much does it cost? What is the environment, general environmental impact of the actual movement? So usually that meant how much fuel was burned and what kind of pollution was added from that fuel. How long did it take and how physically secure was it? Because I want my commodity to end up where I want it in good shape. And now we're learning that we have to understand more complex data related to movement. So we need to understand the logistical path that is moving through. So what are the potential risks along a route to social, human, environmental, infrastructure, and resources? And so, again, we're dealing with a wicked problem, and it's only impossible if we try to break it all down. We have to take a systems approach to looking at it, and it's something we can do.
So is the goal then to identify all of those risks and work together to address them? Or what would you say is the goal of this symposium?
I would say that's the beginning of that. Let me point something out, that risk is a very confusing word, and we all use it very differently, and different specialists will use it wildly differently. And so, for example, a hazard would be, what is the impact of, say, oil when it drops in water? What does it do in the water body? What does it do to organisms? If I ingest it, what does it do to me? And so that's the hazard evaluation. The probability, for example, of losing a load of crude oil, having a spill, is a mathematical element that tells me what the likelihood would be of an incident. But it doesn't tell me what's going to happen from that. So risk is really, for our use, is going to be hazard, understanding what the outcomes could be against probability of an actual spill. So for example, we take for granted flying around the country. Well, the hazard of an airline crash is horrendous. We know that. But the probability of that crash is extremely low. So it now is the safest way to travel from New York to San Francisco. And yet it's by far, by accident, one of the largest hazards. So trying to understand risk and get beyond some of the emotional implications at the individual level and be wise, that's very difficult. And it, again, it takes dialogue and it takes cooperation and it takes patience and it takes good science.
Well, I know that there are people who are probably listening out there right now who just would love to see the end of crude oil transportation immediately. What kind of problems would that pose to all these different things that you say are tied together?
Well, again, if you don't move the crude oil from one place, it has to come from another place. So there are, for example, federal security issues, energy security issues. And if we don't take it from North America, then we take it from the Middle East. If we don't use oil at all, that leaves us in a huge gap. What would you use? So if there was no oil tomorrow, mobility in the country would just shut down. There'd be no way to move. You couldn't move your car. You couldn't take a flight. There wouldn't be materials for manufacturing. It would be catastrophic. And so again, you can change anything, but you need to acknowledge the trajectory you're on and slowly make that change. And I think that's happening. I think it's happening within industry on its own because they want to stay in business. They would rather stay ahead of the curve than be behind the curve trying to play catch up. And I think that as our awareness as a society changes, we do a better and better job. But again, you could not just shut off oil. And let me give you a quick example. So in Green Bay, you have an 8-inch pipeline that's carrying only a single commodity, basic fuel, for trucks and cars. And it's an old line, and it's decided they should just shut it down. Well, it creates a catastrophic outcome for the Upper Peninsula in northern Wisconsin. And the governors of the two states, Michigan and Wisconsin, have to give special dispensation for trucks to roll down, heavy trucks to roll down the road, which are themselves quite dangerous, which are substantially more prone to accidents and spills, but on a much smaller scale in terms of the spill, for example. And also, marine transport has to carry a tremendous amount between Green Bay and the Upper Peninsula. So, and it has to be carried year-round, so now you need special dispensation from the federal government for ice breaking year-round. So now this tiny little issue, this single small pipeline, almost a footnote in the world of pipelines, has a major consequence. And so you can imagine what these major lines would mean. And so at the moment, there are no simple solutions. But what we can do is we continuously understand and better manage through the use of transparent and inclusive discussion across that triple bottom line and get to a better and better place. And again, you know, I would love a world with no oil involved in it. No hydrocarbons of any kind. I think everybody would love something like that, but we're not there today. And the journey to get there is going to take some time. And so during that time, we need to be making wise choices about how we move and the kinds of move those kinds of materials and the logistics that we choose to use.
So at this symposium, I know you said you've got academians or academicians. I don't know what the right word is, but
academics is fine.
Yeah, I mean, you've got all these different players at the table. So do you feel like people have been working in their own silos on crude oil transportation, or do you think there's that awareness of the entire system and a willingness to work together to make it work as efficiently as possible?
Well, it's interesting you say that, because I think that traditionally we do work in our own silo, and actually there's some risk at sharing all of our cards with everybody. And so industry can be afraid to have an open and clear discussion with regulators because for fear that any sign of weakness would create a lawsuit or an opening. And the general public has a fear and a distrust both of regulators and industry. And so depending on your perspective, we tend to have confirmation bias. That is, we tend to look for the information that fits our view of the world. And by cross-pollinating between multiple disciplines, multiple kinds of organizations, we start to gain better and better, a better picture overall and better traction. And so, you know, think about this meeting. Who's sponsoring it? This is the Great Lakes Network sponsoring this with participation and sponsorship from the Great Lakes Commission, another organization looking at basin-wide issues, and the International Joint Commission, our binational treaty organization for issues within the Great Lakes. And all of these are doing their own research, but they also realize that unless we collaborate and we jointly combine the tracks we're on, we'll be missing the picture. And so, again, we have to work collaboratively. We have to build bridges. And by the way, industry has to be a player here too, as do the elements of industry, which are manufacturing and transportation and product design and logistics analysis. All these different elements have to come together. And so it's heartening to see this happen, but we're at the beginning here of a long trip. And but it's a very good thing. As long as we're all communicating, as long as we're all truly sharing information, that's a positive outcome.
Well, and speaking of outcomes, what do you hope all the participants will take away from this, or what will come of all the information that's shared at the symposium?
Wow, that's a difficult question. I think each of us takes away what we're ready to take away. Knowing that you're in a room with people who are sincere about communicating allows you to hear more than you normally hear. And so what I'm hoping, what I can personally hope, for myself is that my awareness changes of the complexity of the issue, that I have more data, that I start to understand really what that data means, and that eventually people have the wisdom to implement that understanding to give us, to retain our mobility and our freedom of movement, to retain our economic opportunity in the Great Lakes, to allow some growth within the Great Lakes communities, and to allow preservation and even mitigation and cleanup of the Great Lake itself and the Great Lakes Basin. And I think all these things are possible if we work together.
And I know you've kind of touched on a lot of this already, but just to like slam the point home, why is this symposium so important?
Well, we're dealing with a wicked problem. And sometimes problems are so complex that you have to be highly intelligent and extremely well-informed just to be undecided about them. It's very complicated. And by embracing that complexity with a group of partners with diverse abilities and awareness, we have a chance to improve that triple bottom line, which is environmental quality, economic opportunity, social justice. And so I'm optimistic. I think the fact that this is happening in and of itself forced us, this broad array of individuals, to start communicating in a different way. And so the outcomes have already started just by putting the conference together. And it'll be interesting to see what kinds of questions are raised, what kinds of research initiatives are generated, and what kinds of opportunity are created.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me about all the things that are being considered at the symposium. Is there anything that I'm missing that you want to add?
I guess if I had one thing to close on, I would say that rational thought and science is something that needs to be coupled with social emotional intelligence to come to good outcomes. And we don't always do that well. And so that, to me, is the challenge of this particular meeting, to bring those two things together. And it might even be the challenge for the 21st century, that we embrace that triple bottom line and that we relax a little bit, a bit about trying to solve every problem and think about continuous management as we move to better and better solutions until perhaps the issue of hydrocarbons is not an issue at all because we've turned the corner. But until then, let's not turn a blind eye and use default mechanisms to transport this material. Let's be wise and use best available science and human dimension awareness to do the best job we can.
Again, you were just listening to Dale Bergeron. He's a maritime transportation specialist and an extension educator with Minnesota Sea Grant in Duluth, and he works with the entire Great Lakes Sea Grant Network. We're going to take a short break for these announcements, but stick around, there's more to come. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for being with us on this Friday. The threats to clean water are many, but state and federal laws set drinking water standards to protect public health. Wisconsin residents on municipal systems may think that means their water is always safe to drink. But researchers say viruses are finding their way into water sources undetected, and climate change may only make matters worse. A city well in Washburn is pumping 323 gallons of water a minute up the hill to the city's reservoir. That's according to city water operator Ross Leitner. Washburn has two wells that provide drinking water to about 900 households. The city is among 56 municipal water utilities statewide that don't regularly disinfect their drinking water. Leitner says the city meets state standards by testing for what's called total coliform bacteria.
We meet our bacterial levels without having to disinfect. We test three times a month required by the DNR.
The tests reveal any problems that may exist in a drinking water system or well. If tests don't reveal anything, Leitner says there's no need to disinfect.
Wisconsin DNR is telling us that we don't have to, so if we don't have to chlorinate our water, it's kind of, you know, why would you kind of thing, you know?
Makes sense, but Chris Uejo thinks they should. He says one reason is the link he's researching between rainfall and illness. The assistant geography professor at Florida State University studied the rate of stomach illness among kids in northern Wisconsin communities that do and don't disinfect their drinking water.
And in these areas where they were treating their drinking water, we did not find any systematic relationship between rainfall and new human illnesses. But we did find a pretty systematic and consistent relationship in these communities in northern Wisconsin that were accessing municipal water that was untreated.
Simply put, rain is transporting viruses that make people sick into drinking water sources. Using climate models, UASIO's study shows young kids in those communities will be more likely to fall ill from untreated drinking water as the area sees more frequent intense rainfall due to climate change.
We found a pretty modest increase due to climate change.
UASIO says that ranged anywhere from a 1 to 2% increase in the rate of stomach illnesses. Wisconsin Geological Survey hydrogeologist Madeline Gotkowitz says communities that don't treat their water aren't doing anything wrong. They're just following state standards.
But the way a lot of people interpret that is if their well passes the total coliform test, then the water must be safe to drink.
But those tests don't look for the presence of viruses that UASIO says are making people sick. USDA Agricultural Research Service microbiologist Mark Borkart says a 2007 study revealed pathogens could penetrate layers of rock thought to filter out contamination.
When it rains, people should understand that's when contamination happens. So many people have this view of groundwater being ancient and deep and coming from an underground river, and actually a lot of it's just the rain that fell on the ground 2 weeks earlier.
The findings swayed the Wisconsin DNR to revise its drinking water rules so that all municipal water utilities would have to disinfect, but the legislature nixed that requirement in 2011. Opponents argued local governments should decide whether to treat their water. They pointed to added costs for cash-strapped communities and even taste. Washburn City Administrator Scott Kluver says they get quite a few complaints from residents when they have to disinfect their drinking water.
There's usually a line of people trying to fill up water at the artesian well because they don't like the smell or the taste of the chlorine.
But UASIO says his study found that treating drinking water would prevent 82% of stomach illnesses associated with rainfall in communities that don't regularly disinfect. As Wisconsin sees hotter, wetter weather, those communities may see residents lining up more often at the doctor's office instead and paying more out of pocket to treat illnesses that could have been prevented. This story is part of a year-long reporting project at Wisconsin Public Radio called State of Change, Water, Food, and the Future of Wisconsin. You can find these stories on Morning Edition, All Things Considered, the Ideas Network, and online at wpr.org/change. For more than 50 years, clergy from the Apostle Islands have gathered in June to bless local boats for safe passage and a prosperous season on Lake Superior. The city of Bayfield will hold its annual Blessing of the Fleet this weekend. In an interview with KUWS reporter Elizabeth McMahon, Bayfield Mayor Gordon Ringberg said the tradition goes back thousands of years across many civilizations near water.
Where the fishermen would, you know, ask for some divine assistance so that they would have safe trips, and they would come back with their nets and boats full of fish. And so we continue that tradition here in Bayfield, not only for the fishermen, but also for all the boaters, the pleasure craft boaters, and also for our Coast Guard friends and Marine Patrol.
Ringberg said every religion in town is represented at the Blessing of the Fleet, and they will bless each boat that has registered as they float by the harbor. The Blessing of the Fleet will be held this Sunday, June 11th at 1 p.m. And we bring you this clip from our audio archives on the Blessing of the Fleet held 5 years ago in Bayfield.
The blessing of God Almighty, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit be upon you and remain with you always.
Thank you. God's blessings. Enjoy the creation. Be soon.
I like the fact that they have a galvanized bucket of Lake Superior holy water and the cedar bough, and then that's how they bless the boats going by. Never saw 5 gallons of holy water before.
That's true.
My name is Mark McGinley. I'm from Washburn, and I sail a 25-foot boat named the Yankee Girl.
The grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, the love of God, the fellowship of the Holy Spirit be with you now and forever.
It's an old ritual that went on years and years ago. It blessed the fishing boats every spring to have a good harvest. and it just kind of extended over into recreational boaters too, or anybody, kayakers. You'll see kayakers out there, and canoes and powerboats, sailboats. My name is Barrett Nelson. I've been boating here for my 24th year, and I think I've done the blessing every year that they've had it. Can't hurt to have God on your side, right?
You'll hear a cannon shot, so don't jump. Right. There you go. Maybe it's time to start the service.
Bless the Lord,
O
my soul.
You lay the beams of your chambers in the waters above. You make the clouds your chariot. You ride on the wings of the wind. You make the winds your messengers.
The basis of it is the fishing fleet and the workers who go out and risk their lives so that we can eat trout and whitefish.
These are the families of the great fishing fleet. Erickson, Shaw.
I'm Kevin Gordon, and I'm the pastor of Holy Family Church. I see the fishermen going out early at 5:30 in the morning, and I always say a little prayer when I see their boats going by. Because, you know, it is a tough work and can be very dangerous. So, and some of them are related to me, so I want to pray for them.
Some of my friends are in the fishing, even currently, like the Hoopman, Batans. I've seen what the sea can do, or the lake can do. It feels like a sea. Increasing your odds, whether it's divine intervention or not, it's a good thing.
Through memories, grace, and enduring sense of place, the families and the fleet of the greatest inland sea in the world, Lake Superior.
Amen.
That's it for our program. You can hear it again online on our website at wpr.org/superior. Or you can check us out on our Facebook page at facebook.com/KUWSFM. You've been listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Danielle Kading. We hope to have you back with us again next Friday. Until then, have a great weekend.